they want to act right away, you know? And I think sometimes just again, being patient and going at that person's pace is going to be super helpful. Just knowing that you're there for them. And the thing is, it's not that we're saying not to react. It's more, yes, react. Say that's awful. It shouldn't have happened to you. I believe you. This is good for the person to see that reaction. But then the what to do about it is not your choice, right? And so it's being able to separate the I believe you, this is, should not have happened, to on your own, then dealing with the emotions of what that triggered for you. And I think that separation is really important for villagers and community members. And I would say that it's difficult for me. Like, I'm a counselor and I hear the stories, and I have to do that individual work after hearing those stories because I also get upset inside. And sometimes I want to cry in the session, I'll be honest. It's tough to hear some of the stories, and so doing that individual work outside of the session to, calm myself and do meditation or mindfulness practices, whatever it is I need to do, talk to a supervisor, right? To be able to center myself and get back to what I need to do, I think is important for others to do that too. Right. So that's one thing I think would be helpful. Other things is like, again, if it's in crisis, or you said overtime. So overtime, this could be something that could impact this person for the rest of their lives. It's not something that they're going to get over. It's not something that can be cured. This thing happened to them, and it's a part of their story now for the rest of their lives. And so that's why people talk about sort of this idea of I am a, rape survivor, or I'm a sexual violence survivor, because it's so like it's imprinted now on their life card in a sense. And just like COVID is a part of all of our experiences, it's the same way that experience is imprinted on that person's life. And so they can re they maybe 10, 15 years from now, they'll still refer back to that time. And that may not be negative. It could be a positive thing. Could be like, I overcame that thing and I'm doing much better now. Again, if they haven't dealt with it, it could be negative. It could be like, oh my God, I'm still being, pulled and controlled by that thing that happened to me at that time. And so being able to recognize this, and I think that is something that would be important for people to understand too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just being mindful that, like, the story and the storyteller is actually the person themselves, and we're just here for support. And I know, like, because when you were talking about how sometimes you feel frustrated during certain interactions, hearing certain stories as well, it's like, yeah, if you could just reach out, but then at the same time, it's like on the person, and it's like all about them kind of coming to ter things on their own terms, I guess.
Definitely. Like it's also all about them, that person, and we're just here custodians helping them to navigate through this thing that just happened, right?
And that's like just the responsibility, I guess, that comes with being a part of community. Thank you for sharing that. And just talking more about how communities can support and be there for survivors of sexualized violence, how can communities just be more intentional about supporting the survivors or those impacted by systemic trauma?
Believe them. Like, listen, you know how hard it is for somebody to tell you that somebody violated them in this way? Just believe them. I think that's one of the easiest things a person can do is just say, I believe you. How can I help? What can I do? I think that's one of the biggest things a community could do intentionally too. I think another thing is, to hold that story, not to share it with anybody else. And I think that's another piece of community. Like, community, we come together and we love to be with each other and support each other, but we like to talk about people's business. And I think with a story like this, with this type of support, hold that space for that person. And, don't share that. That is that person's story. And I think that that could be another intentional way that you could help this person is to not share their story, especially if they've entrusted it to you. And so I think that that's also another place that damage can happen to a person, where their story gets shared, to the wrong person, or it could further harm them. So hold the space, hold the story. It's not yours to share, and believe them when they share the story, or what happens to them.
And yeah, just coming into that sort of headspace with just unconditional support for the other person, because like you said, it's absolutely not an easy thing to disclose to anyone. And we even talked about like how sometimes, maybe, and I'm sure like a lot of survivors maybe already do that, where they think about like, oh, how am I going to break this to my family, or am I going to test out the waters? Like the forethought that goes into a disclosure itself as well. So yeah, like I guess the best thing that community can do is just come in with unconditional support and be mindful about like how we're showing up, and making sure that the story is actually the storytellers. As we wrap up this episode, what is one message you'd like to leave with the people who work with similar communities, or who do similar work with communities?
I would say count it a privilege when a person chooses you to be that person they disclose this information to first, or disclose their story to first. And coming from that place of humility, I think really helps to make the storyteller the person who owns the story. And it makes it less about you and more about them. And so you then become the person who is, you're just there to actively listen. You're just there to support. You're just there to help in any way that person needs you to help. You're just there as a resource giver. You're just there to accompany if needed, right? And so when you come from that perspective of, I am, humble. I am honored to hear this story. It puts things into a different perspective. Like, you are not the person in power here. You are here as a supporter of the person who is in power, which is the person with the story. So that's what I think I would leave with people, who are doing this work in community. The attitude and the approach that you have to the work really does make a difference.
And I guess it also like ties into what we were talking about earlier, where people need should separate like how their reactions are versus the way that they're like actually showing up for the person. And it's like that's so important to do, just to make sure that you're aware of the responsibility that is on you when somebody is disclosing something to you, and just how critical that is for the both of you in that moment. Thank you so much for leaving us with that message, and all the wonderful insights, and just how healing a community can be. And there's also like this one thing that I've been seeing around on social media, where it's like the cost of having a community is just sometimes maybe being inconvenienced. And I don't always see that as an inconvenience, because you're showing up, you're like literally just being a part of your community. But I feel like our conversation today really just kind of like reminded me of that a lot, where all you have to do is show up within your capacity. And it's such a simple yet profound thing that you can do to just support in somebody's healing and even like yours as well.
Definitely. I think the more we are able to, not input our own personal stuff, into the helping of another person, we're able to feel a sense of healing for ourselves. We're like, oh, I'm giving for this person. It's just for them. And then if another person's doing the same for us, then we also will feel part of the community. We'll feel that sense of belonging. We'll feel supported too. And so, yeah.
And thank you so much, Trisha, for your time and your words today. I know I took a lot of like important things away, especially with just how healing community can be, and not just like on a personal scale, but on a larger scale as well. And I'm sure like so have our listeners. And thank you so much to everybody listening as well. And remember, healing is not something that we carry alone. It grows and it is sustained through community and care. And thank you so much for joining us for Healing Together, which is a special podcast created in the context of SFU Sexual Assault Awareness Month 2026. You can follow the SVSPO on Instagram and their Instagram handle is at SFU SVSPO to learn more about our work and how we support the SFU community. And we hope that these conversations spark reflection and connection. And until next time, and take care and take care of one another, and stay tuned for the next episode.
This project was made possible through the guidance, technical support, and generous hosting of CJSF 90.1 FM. We wish to recognize the assistance offered by CJSF volunteers, and our gratitude also goes to Duane Woods at the SFU Center for Educational Excellence for editing and episode transcription. If you or someone you know in the SFU community has been impacted by sexualized violence, please reach out to the SVSPO at our website, www.sfu.ca/sexual-violence. To learn more about our events and resources, you can follow us on Instagram at sfu.svspo. Thank you for being part of this conversation and for joining us in community.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. A forest in New Zealand rings with the sound of bellbirds, whose indigenous name is Korimako. Korimako are 8-inch, mossy green birds with dark wings and tail, a purple sheen on the face, and red eyes. They use their down-curved beaks and brush-tipped tongues to feed on nectar from flowers, which they pollinate while they feed. Many birds sing together, especially in the morning. Pairs sing duets. And a pair may countersing with its neighbors, perhaps letting them know that this patch of land is taken. It all builds to a brilliant, ringing dawn chorus. Korimako populations were drastically reduced in the 19th and early 20th century by disease and rats. Thanks to predator control, their numbers are increasing in some places. So their brilliant songs may ring through forests for years to come. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. BirdNote gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.
This is Diana Cardiff, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc and CJSF 90.1 FM.
My name's LaFranc.
This is Diana Cardiff, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Since 2003, the PUSH Festival has been running annually in Vancouver as an interdisciplinary, multimodal space for artists across mediums to interact and perform. Today, I'm speaking with Gabriel Martin, the artistic director for the festival. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
In what ways do local artists and communities shape PUSH's identity, and how do artists from across Canada and beyond fit into that?
Yes, thanks for the question. I think, you know, each year there are local works in the festival that are so critical to balance the international and the national. And I think those works are always in dialogue with each other. That's our goal. And then literally we try and create space for dialogue around them. I'm not just, there are artist talks, you know, after the shows. There are interviews I conduct with artists that are disseminated digitally around the shows, and workshops. But also we have this industry series for arts industry artists, producers, presenters to come together for a week during the festival, see work together. And really to be in dialogue about what it means to create and present in this contemporary moment. It's a really important platform also for local artists to get their work seen by colleagues, people they know or don't know from across Canada, from abroad. That's a rare opportunity because of our relative geographic isolation. And it's a really important role that PUSH plays. And from the beginning, the festival was envisioned as an international festival, but an international festival that is creating that space for dialogue and exchange by having artists local, national, and abroad sharing stages, sharing spaces. That's something that's special about a festival that's different from a seasonal presentation kind of format where everybody's in the city at the same place, at the same time, same place. And there's something that's possible because of the relationships that, you know, emerge, or at least the potentiality of that. And then your second question was about national artists, was it?
Yeah, from across Canada, then beyond. So worldwide, international.
Yeah, the festival is fundamentally about expanding our sense of the world, our paradigms for expression and relation. So having the intersection of diverse perspectives and practices is really like the foundation of what this festival is about and has been from the very beginning when, you know, it started at a time where there were very few presenters presenting national, international, contemporary performance. So, you know, a lot of the work presented in this festival is interdisciplinary or adventurous in form, is in conversation with social and political urgencies. And we're still limited in terms of the number of presenters and just kind of the scale of our scene locally in terms of the capacity to welcome that kind of work. So, you know, it was especially critical in the moment it was started in terms of being able to bring work that wouldn't otherwise come here. And now there's more opportunities, there are more presenters, but it still remains unique. And I am not, I don't think I'm out of place in saying that it's very critical. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, as artistic director, what are some of the core values that guide your curatorial decisions for the festival?
Mm-hmm. Well, that it's a truly international festival. And it's in the title and maybe that sounds obvious, but it's actually quite complicated to present a festival that has work that is from the global north as well as the global south because of the economics, because of the kind of neo-colonial economic reality, cultural economics, where there's just so much more support from, you know, in general, from countries that are part of the global north to financially support touring artists and creative export. That doesn't happen in a lot of other places in the world. And so that's a real value and priority in terms of being able to create some equity in terms of who we see on stage when we say international, who that it's not just artists from Europe, even though there are obviously lots of great artists from Europe and also lots of diasporic, like artists that belong to diasporic cultures from elsewhere in the world based in Europe. Yeah, so that is one. And, you know, we aim to support that value or realize that value by also investing in co-productions where we can, you know, which is a limited resource at this point, but I'm trying to develop that. So, for example, tonight we premiere Kamwe Kamwe, which is a work we're co-producing by the Zimbabwean dance company Jerihuni Movement Factory. Yeah, that's just one of the ways that we work towards that. And beyond that, the values, I mean, that I kind of mentioned the simple mandate to expand our sense of the world. And so that is really done by how the work helps us situate ourselves in relationship to the issues, you know, the contemporary global issues. And that also sparks our imagination because that's where change happens. That's where we can imagine different, better futures, otherwise ways of living, being. And so I really hope that the festival does, you know, is work that transforms and transports us and really gives us a sense of possibility and potential by offering us something that's an experience that we haven't experienced before.
On that note, I want to look a little bit more at the audiences and who do you imagine PUSH is for in terms of the audience? Who are you still trying to reach and how do you invite audiences into more unfamiliar works?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge. I mean, there's always so much more resource we could put into marketing and outreach. It's a truly diverse festival in terms of, as mentioned, the perspectives and practices on stage. But I think in this city, performing arts often get siloed. And, you know, there are people who go to see dance shows, often dancers. And then there's people who don't, you know, just for an example. And a lot of the projects have content or thematics that can speak to a really broad audience. But if they don't already have a theater going practice, it's a real challenge. And so I think we kind of work at it slowly, you know, to the capacity we can. We do have an accessible PUSH program, which is focused on integrating access supports into the shows and working with artists to develop elements of the shows that can be developed so that they are more accessible to various people with different barriers to participation. And part of that role is the community ticketing. So specifically that focus is on partnering with organizations that serve and work with people who have financial barriers to participation. But also, this is Andrea Cowden, and I just need to give her a shout out because she's so great. We do collaborate as well on, you know, for each project, okay, you know, is there a specific cultural community who, you know, would really, who this work is speaking to, that share a lived experience of the artist on stage that might connect with this work? And we do that to the extent that we can. I think this year we're talking about the festival as being a festival for the culturally fearless, and that's meant as less of a challenge and more as an invitation, hoping to cultivate a kind of practice of theater going where, you know, it's not just about I like it or I don't like it, but that there can be more of a like, okay, I didn't like this part of it. Why didn't I like this part of the show? But I did like this part of it. And why did I like this? Or why do, what are the other things affecting my experience of this work? Where do I think the artist is coming from? Did the artist achieve what they were trying to do? Like all those, you know, that ideally if the work sparks conversation, emotional response, that that there's some value in that. Because the thing is it is a very diverse festival and we have very diverse audiences. So that means that not every piece in the festival is for everybody that intersects with PUSH. So it's about how we try and communicate the work, and then also how we're trying to cultivate in our audiences a cultural fearlessness for different experiences. And we hope that people come to more than just one show in the festival so that they can get a bit of a breadth of experience and see how those, how the different pieces might be in conversation with each other.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of artists tend to thrive in the environment that PUSH curates?
Well, in terms of the artists that are part of the program, I would say a lot. But like, I wish that I could support more artists in being presented at PUSH, because as mentioned, there's such a lack of presentation opportunities and opportunities to have their work made visible beyond the city. But yeah, as mentioned, you know, there are a lot of artists. I'm going to start that over. So I spoke about adventurousness and form, and I think the festival prioritizes artists working interdisciplinarily, taking creative risks, working in unconventional ways, experimenting. So not a lot of conventional expressions of form. There are very few pieces in the festival where you can say, oh, that's dance or that's theater, because of that porousness in expression. And and I would say also that it's important that, you know, I try and think about cultural urgency. You know, we're living in a poly crisis. So for me, artists whose work is in relation to that reality, and it doesn't have to be in a literal way with, you know, a very with literal text about the experience of living now and in these times, though literal text can be part of it, but that their practice and that their lived experience, and that, you know, they're creating from a place that is conscious of that reality with the wider world. So I think that's even something, you know, it might be a local artist, but the influences and the conversations they're part of, and the way they're engaging, the research they're doing is engaged with a wider sense of the world.
And you've been with the festival for a couple years now. What surprised you the most about directing PUSH?
What has surprised me the most? That's a great question. I'm having a hard time coming up with the answer to that one. What surprised me the most? I think that sometimes there are... I don't think I have an answer for that question right now. Sorry.
That's fine. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I just got one more before I let you go. What excites you the most about the festival's future?
Well, right now we're kind of taking it year by year. There will definitely be a PUSH next year. So I don't mean to, you know, alarm anyone, but there is a kind of living in the moment, experience because of the financial precarity. So it's hard to plan far in advance, just specifically with regards to arts funding. I will speak to, though, what I'm excited about in this festival. And I would say it's all the artists that are bringing us into diffracted and deep senses of time, that are giving us a sense of a more macro experience, that are weaving in ancestral and ancient embodied practices, and also opening up futurisms that exist outside of like the futures that dominant culture wants to provide for us. So I'm really excited that there are so many projects in this festival that really expand our sense of existence, and help situate us in relation to possible futures. And there are so many projects that I'm just really excited to experience. There's so many, but, you know, Ask You One is one of these, catching up to the future of our past. Remember that time we met in the future, Split Two, Separate Gigi. The list is pretty long.
Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for meeting with me on such short notice.
Yeah, thank you for your interest and push. Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.